So anyway, this is work that's done by myself at the Benjamin Levitch Institute and at Yale with Corey O'Hearn and these students, Carl Schreck, Thibaut Bertrand, and Tenchi Shen, all contributed to the stuff that I'll be talking about. What I'm going to talk about today are simple model systems, okay, that are relatively small. You can see this is the size of the system, 60 particles-ish. These are 2D frictionless bidisperse systems, okay? So they have a 50-50 mixture of large and small. The ratio of large to small is 1.4. This is mainly just so we don't have to worry about crystallization in these systems, so they'll always be amorphous. Okay, and what we can do is we can jam these systems, and we jam them by just randomly throwing down their positions and then growing them in the computer until they touch. Once they touch, they just push each other out of the way until there's no way for them to push anybody out of the way without overlapping. At that point, we call them jammed. So they're not overlapping, but if they were to be increased even a little bit, or if any one or any collection of them were to try to move, they would overlap. So there's no way for them to move, also no way for them to grow. Okay, and then what we're going to do is vary a number of parameters and try to understand the properties of these types of jammed systems, like varying the temperature, measure things like the vibrational density of states, measure response to shear. Okay, so I'll talk about shear a little bit later at the end. So I want to set up a very explicit difference between granular systems and other types of systems that maybe some more of you are familiar with. And that is, in granular systems, at least the type we're talking about, dry, cohesionless granular systems, just basically thinking here of hard particles, they have a force when they're overlapping or when they're touching. Okay, they have a repulsive force, but they have no attractive force. There's no way to pull them together. So once they're not touching, the force is absolutely zero. That's not the case in most real materials. In most real materials, there's a force when they're overlapping, pushing them apart, but there's also a force pulling them back together. So if you have a Lennard-Jones system or any real system, you're going to have this attractive force as well. So the way we talk about this is we call these purely repulsive. That is, there's never any way to attract them together. Can't be attracted together on their own. Versus double-sided, or attractive and repulsive. They have two sides of their potential. Okay, so this
granular system is not real. Because you keep saying real systems, any real system has some attractive energy.
I should have been saying microscopic or molecular systems. Thank you, Corey, for mentioning that. Granular systems are actually real. We have them in my laboratory.
But in a granular system, you would have friction on top of that.
On a granular system, you would have friction, and that's something that we're adding in as we go.
Yes. A little bit charged, right?
They could be a little bit charged, but you can always... So in that case, there's actually granular systems. This is a good point. I should mention this, since not everyone here is a granular expert. There's basically two types of granular systems that we often talk about, cohesionless and systems with cohesion, okay? Systems that are small enough, or there's some sort of charge or something that's large enough that the cohesion makes an effect, that will change the property of the material. And a very simple example is if you're baking and you spoon out a spoonful of sugar and you pour it into your thing, it just makes a pile. But if you pull out a spoonful of flour, you put it in, it stays in the shape of the spoon. Okay, it can't pull apart. It won't just flow out on its own. So that's cohesionless versus a type that has cohesion. Generally speaking, the difference is how small the molecule, how small the particle is. So typically, if particle size is greater than, let's say, 50 microns, you'll be in this cohesionless regime. If you're below that, depending on the material and so forth, but there's maybe between 10 and 50. Microns will determine the difference between those two. But we want to set this up in terms of a theory between the two types, okay? Whichever systems apply up here versus the type of systems that apply down here, whether they're real or not. And these are, none of these systems that we talk about today are actually real. They're in a computer, so that's, there's always that, okay? So as I said, yes?
I had a stupid question.
Please.
When you said the ratio of the diameters was 1.4.
Yes.
Presumably, there are some special ratios that would lead to crystallization. Is that a finite list?
Yes.
Avoiding those particular?
Yeah, that's a finite list if you mean by mixed crystals. Okay, every system eventually will likely, if it's large enough, would likely phase separate and then crystallize. Even if you had polydispersity, it would just find its own, everyone would find their own thing. Eventually, like in the lifetimes of the universe kind of time. But yeah, there are special sizes that lead to mixed crystals. Like, for example, sizes where the small particle fits inside the interstices of the large particle. Also, if the difference is not small enough, it'll form a crystal, but not a perfect crystal. But there are special packings for special ratios. We actually just have a recent paper by Kai sitting next to you on discussing the kinds of ratios of particle sizes that create special classes in PRL. So if you're interested.
Even if you hit the intermetallic ratio, because you need macroscopic phase separation, you need to get the small light particles in the right.
You also need a mixture ratio. So it's not only a specific size ratio, but a specific mixture ratio is required to create these special crystals, right? Because if you're fitting in interstices, there's maybe less or more interstices in different crystal packings than in others, okay? So it's a special, and all the way around to get these special ones. But we choose this so that we don't get any of that. So that's why we choose this particular one, yes.
So the initial structures that you get just by jamming packing coming from the dilute side.
Yeah.
Does it really matter that you take bias first?
Yes, absolutely. They'll just crystal one, boom, like that.
During the initial compression.
Absolutely. They're, you know, 90% of the 2D packings will be crystals if you don't do this.
But I was going to say that the intermetallic ratios do not crystallize.
No, they don't, because they have a special, when you have two sizes and you want to crystallize those, they also have to be in a special local ratio as well as a global ratio. And so when you put them down randomly, they're not in that local ratio. So when you jam them rapidly, that is when you just grow them as rapidly as you can, they're not in that ratio and they won't form that crystal. It's a kind of special. 2D disks of monodisperse crystallize very readily compared to any other system. Even 3D monodisperse does not crystallize so readily. Even though, of course, people think there's no crystal in 2D. Yes.
So the avoidance of the system which has a grain boundary type thing, you're saying you avoid that because you don't go to huge times. Huge Poincaré time type things are a function of the number of particles you have.
Correct.
So you would see that if you had too few particles, given the time of your simulation.
Okay. We wouldn't in the simulations we do, because we don't allow any extra time. So we don't ever allow the particles to move freely. They only move by moving out of the way of each other. Otherwise, they're completely damped. So this is what's called a steepest descent, or absolute fast quench. This is the fastest quench possible. Okay, so that's how we do this. So there's no time. Doesn't matter how long you wait in these. There's just the time it takes to crystallize them, and that's it. There's no other time. And there's in these systems, it's very difficult to crystallize them if you have more than one size. Okay, so here's the type of system that we're talking about. Okay, it's disordered, like this packing you see here. Okay, but and if we had a crystal, what we would do, of course, is just expand it in sines and cosines, because there's a perfect lattice and we could do this very easily. Turns out, if you didn't know already, there's a way to expand a disordered crystal in the same sort of way. Okay? And you do this by doing the Taylor expansion around the crystal state. So you can see the state is moving, okay, but there's an average position to the particles. That's the packing below. And we take that position and we subtract it off from the current position. That gives us a difference in positions. Okay, now we can expand the potential energy in this difference variable, and we can get what's called a dynamical matrix. Okay, this dynamical matrix will be dn by dn, and from it we can actually extract a solution if we do the linear assumption there. So we can get just the linear part we keep, then we can solve Newton's equations exactly in this linear approximation, and we can actually get the positions of the particles at all times. Every particle, all times, to tell us exactly where the particles will be at any time later, all the particles, depending on our initial conditions. Now, what I've done here in this particular packing is to set up a special initial condition. This matrix, this dynamical matrix, gives us both eigenvalues, which tell you the frequencies of these solutions, but also gives you eigenvectors, which tell you the way that the particles will be moving. Okay, you know, if I had two particles, I could have them moving apart like this, or I could have them moving together. These are the eigenvalues of this system, the eigenvectors of this system. And what I've done is I've excited one of those eigenvectors. Okay, yes.
I have a very naive question.
Sure.
I mean, if I see this little two blue, overlap, so this is just an elastic deformation, and then they go up.
It's a good question, and the answer is no. The answer is that these motions are very, very tiny. Okay, if I want to stay in this linear regime and I want to excite these linear modes without breaking the crystal, without breaking the packing, I have to do very, very small. So what I've done here, so you can see what's going on, is I've multiplied this by a million. So this is the motion multiplied by a factor of 10 to the 6. Okay, so these guys are not actually overlapping. They're just moving a tiny amount. But if I show it on a scale where these guys do not overlap, you can't see it. Okay, because it's in this packing situation, and so all the particles are very, very close together, and even the ones where they have a little bit of space in between them, it's very small space, and so you just really can't see what's happening. So I've done this strictly for visualization purposes, so you can sort of see what the modes do. And this one, for example, you can see, you know, it pushes out and pushes in over here. It kind of has a little circulation to it that brings motion up to the top. This is one particular, yes?
If you did excite along the mode and they contacted, or they broke the contact, what would you do?
In fact, that is the subject of the talk. So we'll continue and we'll find out what happens when these sorts of things occur. Yes?
So if I treated the walls of your container like one large ball.
You do, and that's in the potential energy. Yeah.
It is, okay.
Yeah. Was that your question?
Yes.
Yes, yes. In this case, this is inside a box. Most of what I'll show you is actually periodic boundary conditions. But this one is actually in a box, and so the walls are part of the potential energy that you have to expand as well. So it's just part of the expansion that you do as well. If you don't have that, then you have to have all the extra terms, which will change the dynamical matrix to include the periodic boundary conditions, which I'll talk about more in detail a little bit later.
So does it mean that during this very small motion, either they have always contact these two nails, or they never have contact?
Yes, if that's going to be, you've anticipated most of the point of this talk, which is that in order to have this kind of motion, this dynamical matrix driven motion, you have to be in contact at all times. Okay, so you have to be in contact at all times, and that's going to be the thrust of most of what happens. Yeah.
Within the range of your spring.
You can go as far in as you want, but you can't go out far. These are single-sided potentials. So these are the granular potentials, so you can go in as far as you want, but if you ever come out past the end of the particle, then you change things dramatically, and that's what we're actually going to talk about.
How come I don't see the walls moving by a million times?
Okay, so in the equation for the potential, I set the walls as a fixed position, so they have essentially an infinite mass. Okay, so that's the way that we deal with those. You could have compliant walls if you wanted to, but then you have to do a lot of work on the walls. You could have a simple compliant wall which was perfectly straight but had one spring attached to it, or you could do even something more exotic where you solve some other equation to find the shape of the wall based on the forces that are on it. But at any rate, in this case, what we did was just the simplest case, which is that the walls are perfectly hard, and so the walls have the same elastic constant as the particles, but they cannot move. They're totally fixed. Right. Infinite mass.
In last week's talk, you plotted center of mass. Does that mean to use a different method then?
No. So in that last week's talk was an experiment, and so the walls were not perfectly compliant, but they were, perfectly infinite mass. They have a mass, but the mass ratio was about a factor of 10,000 to the particle mass, and so they don't move to the level we have accuracy to measure. Okay. Plus, even so, the center of mass of the entire thing is also conserved. So even if they were going to move, it wouldn't be anything that would change the center of mass of the particles, because they would all move together. So the measured center of mass would be literally the center of mass of the entire system, even though the contribution from the walls would be very, very small. Okay, so this is what happens when we excite a single mode. And by the way, this simulation is not repeating. Okay, the entire time I've been talking, this goes on for about 45 minutes, I have been just letting the simulation run. Okay, the simulation just runs. So it's in the same mode the entire time, forever, literally as long as we want to run it.
So these are linearized equations? Or
these are not the linearized equations. These are the actual equations with the nonlinearities in it, yet they continue to run essentially indefinitely in this mode,
so
no matter how long.
So you compute the spectrum of eigenmodes, you perturb the system along one of those eigenmodes by a finite but small amount.
And this is the result. And this goes on as long as I'm willing to wait. And on our large computers back home, we've let it run 10 to the 8, 10 to the 10.
No friction or viscosity.
There's no friction or viscosity in the system. So it's energy conserving in this case. Of course, if I were to go to real granular systems, then I would have I'd have to have some dissipation forms, and then this would die out. But it would die out along this mode. It wouldn't spread out. Okay, it would die out along this mode. Okay? So this is basically what happens. Okay. So from this, we can extract what's called the vibrational density of states. Okay? So what we want to do is we want to understand what frequencies make up all possible motions of this system. And again, as I mentioned before, one way to get that is from this dynamical matrix. So we can take this dynamical matrix, we can extract its eigenvalues, and then we can construct a density of states from delta functions at each one of those eigenvalues. That will be our density of states, okay? That's one way to construct the density of states. It's just delta functions at the frequencies we know that the system will actually go. This is kind of a theoretical density of states, okay? This is sort of the theoretical version of the density of states, okay? It's not what we would actually measure. Now, there's two ways that people measure the density of states, okay? One way is to take the actual velocities with all the nonlinearities in the problem, and take the autocorrelation function of those velocities, normalize it, and take the Fourier transform, okay? In the case that we have this solution, so if we have this solution to the problem, and we do that exact operation on that analytic solution, then we get exactly what we get from the dynamical matrix, okay? These things are perfect sines and cosines, they have perfect delta function responses, and so we get exactly the same density of states we get by creating this delta function system out of the dynamical matrix. So analytically, these two give us identical results. Now there's a third way that people have used to extract the density of states, and that's from the covariance matrix. So now I take the position covariance, and I take the velocity covariance, and those two can be related in such a way that also if the solution is this linearized solution that I had before, then that will give us a new dynamical matrix, which in that limit where everything is linear will give us exactly the same thing as well. So all three of these things give us exactly the same thing. Yeah.
For the covariance matrix, you need thermal equilibrium.
You do not. Because you can take this further into thermal equilibrium. If you want to, instead of using the velocity correlation matrix, you use the temperature. And so if you want, this should be a in equilibrium. This is a diagonal matrix whose eigenvalues or diagonal elements are the temperature. And in that situation, when it's in equilibrium, then in that case, you would have this situation you're talking about, which is another thing you can do. So in equilibrium, you can replace this matrix with the temperature, and you get a similar thing, but where this is not a matrix, but this is just the temperature or KB or the temperature over KB or something like that. And that's something you can also do, but in this case, if you include the velocities themselves, it's always true at any time, also out or in an equilibrium.
But if you pluck it, if you initialize it along one particular mode, then you would be erroneously led to the conclusion that the eigenvalues of all the other modes were either infinity or zero, depending on the.
Okay, so that brings us to another issue, that this method, because it involves an inverse, you don't always get all the solutions. Okay, so if you don't have any, if there's a particular mode you don't have any power in, then it won't show up here, it won't show up here. This equation is, the other equation is still true. V equals kappa times C, that's still true. That will always be true. But because you're missing parts of it, it won't be invertible. So this one can fail, this method can fail if you don't have power in some of the modes, okay? So this one can fail.
I think it's just like that one at the bottom, can't
be. This one cannot fail in that same sense because this one is telling you the current density of states of this system. So you'll be telling you the current, and we're not inverting anything here, so we don't have to worry about that. The only reason we have to worry about it here is because we end up with, the way we've solved the problem, we end up with inverting a matrix, which means if it's zero, then it'll be infinite and we'll be in trouble. But here we're not doing that. So in this case, this is literally representing what are the frequencies in this system. Okay, so we can think of this as what are the frequencies in this system. You can think of this as what do we think the frequencies should be from the analytics. And this one is kind of a hybrid, okay? It's telling us an equation that they obey, which we could possibly invert to get their dependence, okay? So these are the three ways that we have of extracting information from this system, okay?
So how come the dynamical matrix and the covariance matrix would give you the same result?
Well, it's not obvious, but if you work it out, so I take the U's from here, okay? I can get the U's from here. I can get the velocities from here as well by just differentiating with respect to time. These all turn to sines, and we get the frequencies out front. So now I have both U and V.
Is there orthogonal sines and cosines?
No, it's not so obvious. It's not so obvious how it all works out. Then I calculate these using those equations, and I can then identify when I relate these two together, I can identify that they differ by the dynamical matrix in the limit of long times. Okay, so if I go to long times, where these delta functions like here will become nice and sharp, then I can identify this as this relationship is true. It's only true if the system is linear. It's not true otherwise. Okay. But yeah, you can just directly calculate. If you're interested, I've done it on my website. So if you're interested, I've done all the details of this. Some of those I can show that.
But you're assuming an ansatz.
The ansatz that it's linear. Yeah. That these are the solutions. I'm saying these are the solutions. If these are the solutions, what would happen? Yeah, that's the ansatz, is this equation, which is based on saying that the potential can be expanded as a parabola, basically. Okay, so it's a linear approximation. So this is only true in the linear approximation. Okay, so this is true in the linear approximation. Okay, so any more questions about how these three things work? Because we've got these three things, we're going to compare them now in the real system, so in these real packings. Okay, so here's an example. So what we have here is a system that is slightly overcompressed. Okay, so we've jammed it. Okay, we've set it at a particular jamming point, and then we've overcompressed it a little bit, 10 to the minus 6. If we didn't overcompress it at all, then as soon as we started moving, they would come apart. Okay, so we have to overcompress it a little bit in order to see anything. Okay, so we're going to overcompress it a little bit. So we're overcompressing it by 10 to the 6th, okay? And this is for a small system, so we can see every single thing. We can see all the frequencies really easily. Just makes it simpler to see things. Small system, size 10. And we're going to set the temperature very small. So we're going to... Yeah.
Can you give us an idea, like for 10 to minus 6, how many extra contacts are you
adding? No extra contacts.
So there's no extra contacts?
No extra contacts. Okay, so we're just taking the original state, we're compressing it enough that we can do something.
Is that strange that you compress it and there are no extra contacts?
Thank you, Corey, for that question. People think in the large system limit that you can't compress the system at all without increasing the contacts. Of course, in any finite system, you always can, obviously. So there's a question about what happens in all these systems at large number. So what happens at large number compared to what happens at small number? But the way I think about it is that in most real granular problems, I don't have a large number. So I don't really care what happens when it's Avogadro's number of particles. There's no Avogadro's sand pile on the world. Okay, the biggest sort of sand piles that we have are, you know, not that big. And so we're really interested in what happens to the finite size. So there may be some, it's like the debate that people have over whether there's crystallization in 2D. Okay, any size system that anybody has ever made in 2D crystallizes and has a first order phase transition, no matter how big they make it. I mean, I saw one where someone was doing a billion particles, crystallized like that, no problem, easy peasy. Yet all the theorists say, 2D cannot crystallize. If you go large enough, it will not crystallize. Okay?
But this is the logarithmic effect.
Exactly. This is a logarithmic effect. So I don't care. If I had a granular system the size of the universe, then maybe I would start worrying about this, but I don't, so I'm not worried about it right now. So we're going to talk about systems where we can see these finite size effects. And we're going to understand that it's important to understand these systems just as much especially for granular materials, it's just as much important to that. And also in real systems, and by real systems, I'm sorry, I meant atomic systems, it is also important because now we're starting to look at systems that are very tiny. We have nanomachines, we have nanoparticles, we have all kinds of things where we really are caring about finite size effects. So these are important questions no matter what system you are studying. So anyway, back to this, we have 10 particles, there are no extra overlaps, okay? If there was an overlap, what we would have to do is re-expand about the new state that was created by having the extra overlap. Okay, so that's what we have, nothing really serious to change, even though I went on that long thing about, I don't care about large systems, I can also understand what happens in large systems by that technique. So here's what happens. We have all three measurements on here, okay, on this curve, okay? These peaks are measurements of the Fourier transform of the velocity autocorrelation function, these ones that have some spread, okay? These will always have a spread because we're doing the discrete Fourier transform, okay? We can't take times to infinity. So they're always gonna have a width which is proportional to the time that I've taken my Fourier transform, okay? Now we know these represent delta functions because the width here is exactly that width. So it's the width that you have when you have a delta function response. So if I take a sine function at this frequency and take its discrete Fourier transform with the same number of points, I get exactly the same thing as I have here. Okay, so this is these things have the width that you would expect just because the time. And if I were to do this 10 times longer, they would get 10 times thinner, okay? So these are delta functions. The circles represent the eigenvalues that I found from doing the dynamical matrix. So those are the circles, those are the frequencies that I found. Yes?
So the width of those things is set by the time step in your integration algorithm, not by the duration that you watch the thing.
No, it's set by the duration. So the longer I go, the thinner I can get in real space. Okay, so the longer in time, the thinner I can get in frequency space.
The time step sets the frequency.
So if I wanted to measure something that has a width that has a difference of a very low frequency, right? So if I ask what's the difference in frequency, that's a very low frequency. That's what I'm trying to measure. To measure a low frequency, I have to go a long time. Okay? So the width of these peaks depends on how long I measure, not on the spacing. The spacing determines how far out I can measure. Okay? The spacing sets how far I can measure in this. So it's an inverse between the two. In the frequency space, the distance far out I measure tells me the spacing in time space. The spacing in time space again tells me how far out, but the other way around, the distance in time tells me the spacing in frequency space. Okay, so the total time tells me so that tells me that these things are delta functions, and then the dotted lines are this other measurement, this measurement using the covariance matrix. Okay, so we have these three all lining up just like we expect. This is linear theory. This is what happens in linear systems. Okay, now what happens if we increase the temperature? So we're going to go from 10 to the minus 13 to 10 to the minus 8.
So since you're at such a low temperature, and you were convincing us that if you started it in an eigenmode, it would stay in that eigenmode for as long as you watched, since you're at such a low temperature.
Yes.
You sequentially start these things in each one of the eigenmodes.
We could do that. We aren't currently doing that. We're just randomly.
Okay.
Yeah, so we just put in random modes. This and then we can do several things. This was just actually one realization, but we could also take all those random ones and then average them. We get the same thing. We could put it in each mode sequentially, average those, look at them each sequentially. We can do all those things. They all give us the same result. Okay, now we're going to raise the temperature. Okay, and nothing really happens until we get to something close to 10 to the minus 8. And so now I'm going to show you what happens at 10 to the minus 8. Okay, so now none of these three look the same. Okay, I made a mistake when I showed you this before. The circles are from the covariance matrix. The lines are from the dynamical matrix. It's hard to tell on this plot, but I can tell on the next plot. Okay, so once I got to the next slide, I knew that I was wrong. So the dots are from the covariance matrix technique. Okay, so now we're at 10 to the minus 8 temperature, not that much, still not that great. The temperature, it's not that large compared to our compression level. But now what has happened is a few particles have lost contact. Okay, they've lost contact. And what that does is that changes everything about the frequency spectrum. And now this green curve is the Fourier transform of the autocorrelation function of the velocities. See, it no longer has any peaks. Okay, it's totally spread out. It doesn't have any peaks. If we take this covariance matrix method, well, it gives us something which looks like it might have something to do with this. I mean, maybe there's, you know, less out here and a few more here, and so this density of these might be something like what we have here, but it's not really like it. And for one thing, it doesn't include all this high frequency stuff that's out here, so it doesn't really represent this density of states anymore. And by the way, my own personal perspective is that this is the density of states. This is literally the frequency content of the system. I've literally just taken the system and asked, what is your frequency content by using Fourier transform? So this one is the one I think is the frequency content or the density of states. These other ones are proxies or things that people have used in theory to represent this. And now, to me, these dashed lines and these squares no longer look like they represent the real frequency content of this system. Now, a lot of people think it does, so that's why there's some controversy over this. So this is what happens at 10 to the minus 8. If we go even higher in temperature, we get another result. And here's at high temperature, 10 to the minus 3. Now we're really breaking contacts willy-nilly. And now we have a velocity autocorrelation function Fourier transform that looks almost like a liquid. Okay? If this were a liquid, this would just go up. Okay? And basically diverge at zero. But here it can't diverge because we actually do have a solid. I mean, we are fixed, our center mass is fixed, so it actually has to go to zero at some point, but it looks very much like a liquid at this point. And these correlation matrix measurements don't tell you anything about what's going on in the system. I mean, they tell you that there's more stuff down here, but they don't tell you anything about this long tail that occurs. Yeah.
So both, so for any method other than the measuring the velocity out of correlations, you could imagine recomputing the Hessian matrix as you go along and rediagonalizing as you go along by quenching to some kind of inherent structure. You're just taking the initial Hessian matrix and using that to get your statistics
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Not the correlation matrix.
But you could say the same thing for the correlation matrix. You could take the velocity, you could take the displacement correlations over short windows of time where you believe the system to be oscillating around.
Okay, let's take both questions separately. Uh-huh. So first for the dynamical matrix calculation, yes. You could in fact take each time window. As soon as the contact breaks, you have a new matrix, you rediagonalize that, you look at the frequencies that are there, you accumulate those, and I think that's likely what's really happening. And so I think that sort of measurement would be a very good measurement to do. We haven't checked it to see if it's a very hard calculation, because you have, at this state, you have to do a dynamical matrix calculation at every time step. Every time step essentially has a different contact matrix. So it's hard to do. I'm not saying we can't do it, but we're working on it, but it's not one of the things we've actually done already. I think you're probably right, that's likely what is happening. There could be other things that are happening that could compound that, but that is certainly one thing. Now on the question of the correlation matrix, you can't do that, because the correlation matrix only works in the infinite time limit. So it doesn't even represent its current state unless you can measure it forever, okay? So that's the problem. If you make a time window of it, in order to get rid of the spurious correlations because of a short time window, you add extra correlations that aren't really there, and then you don't get the right answer. So you can't do that one over a short period of time. It requires a long time to do. So that one will not work. But the reason why we compare these three and not the one you're suggesting is because this is what people do in the literature. This is what people use to understand systems as the temperature increases. They use the dynamical matrix at zero. So the idea there is that, well, there's not that much change. If one or two contacts breaks, well, it doesn't make that much difference. We should just have the same one. I mean, it'll be on average, right? I mean, on average, the contact matrix we have is going to be that contact matrix because they're breaking and forming contacts. So on average, it should be that matrix. So that's the matrix that we should use, and those are the frequencies that should be allowed. And so that's why we compare to this, because that's what's done. That's currently the state of the art in understanding the system based solely on its density of states. But we can see there's very different behavior at different temperatures. And here's all three on the same plot, so you can sort of get an idea of what's happening to the real frequencies. So at very small temperatures, you have these discrete peaks. At medium temperatures, you have this sort of solid-like, the long tail with some sort of Debye scaling here. So you have this is like solid-like, and then by the time you have breaking lots of contacts, you have this that looks a lot like a liquid. It looks very similar to a liquid. Okay, so these are the sort of three types of behaviors that we see.
And so what's it? So it looks like there's a characteristic high-end frequency scale where things start to, where the density state starts to go down in your green regime where it's solid-like.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know what sets that upper frequency?
So this could be set by the pressure, by the overlap that we have. It tells us where that's what people find when you do it in a linear regime is that these peaks tend to pile up in this sort of flat fashion if you make the pressure lower and lower and lower. I think that basically the fact that you have this, so in a real solid, sorry, again, in an atomic solid, in a double-sided spring solid, what you have is Debye scaling followed by something else, okay? What you have, and what we think is going on here when you have this long flat, is that we're not in a situation like an ordinary material where there's lots of contacts. So how many contacts per particle are there in a Leonard-Jones system? Well, there's a lot. There's at least all the nearest neighbors, plus, you know, depending on the range of it, there's more. So in your dynamical matrix, it's very full. Your dynamical matrix is very, very full. You have many, many entries in the dynamical matrix. Therefore, if you lose one, you don't change the dynamical matrix very much. Now, take it to the other extreme in a granular system where we have a packing. In a packing, every single contact is needed. If we lose one contact, it's no longer solid. One contact will make the system not solid anymore. Okay? So in that system where every contact is required, you have a lot more low frequency modes. That's the idea. Because so many modes have to be included. Because If I even break one contact, I can't span the whole system anymore. I can't make it rigid anymore if I don't have that one contact. And that means there's going to be a lot more long wavelength modes because I need everybody. You know, I've got these three guys over here. I'm trying to get them to be stable. Well, if I have tons of contacts, I can draw from guys nearby and they'll be very localized and I won't care what's happening way over here. But I've got these three guys done. I've already used all their contacts to do something else. I got to get contacts from over here. And I've already used most of those as well. So I keep having to go further and further away to grab information from contacts to be able to, you know, wiggle these two particles over here to get them to work right. So that's the basic idea, is that it's this sort of flat region is set by the fact that we're near what we call isostatic. We're near the system where the dynamical matrix will start to have a null space, where there will be, if we even lose one contact, we no longer have enough contacts to make the thing rigid anymore. And that's basically the story of this talk, is that in the systems where you have single-sided contacts, you need every contact. We don't have any long-range contacts, so we need every single contact. We break even one. Look, I mean, this is basically breaking one or two contacts, this green curve. And it just totally changes what the density of states looks like. It's no longer a collection of peaks, it's just this huge broad thing. Okay, so that's sort of the idea. Okay, to sort of summarize this in another way, now I'm going to take each one of these states and I'm going to look at them. So now I've got the density of states along this axis, and the color represents the height of each peak. Okay, so I've taken each one of these and I've taken the height of each peak and turned it into a color and put it onto a plot here. So here's at small temperatures, okay? And then we go up, okay? And so what we see is that, okay, it's just perfect, staying in the mode. And then all of a sudden we get to this point and now it starts spanning out and starts jumping out. And very quickly, by the time we get to this point, we just have total broad spectrum. We can no longer see the peaks at all. Nothing happens. Okay, so this was my first dot. Here's the second place we looked, and here's the third place we looked. Okay, now up here, what's happened? Something else has happened here. Okay, something else has happened here. We've gotten to a temperature where now the particles can go past each other. Okay, so now the particles can actually go past each other. It looks like a liquid because it kind of is a liquid. Now the particles can go past each other. Okay, and so this occurs here, and it's, you know, it's somewhere in here. It's these things, this is for a particular system, but if you average these things, they're roughly in the same place. Okay, so what you can see is that there's sort of these three regimes, maybe plus a small transition regime, okay, when we go from here to here. And these are the sort of three states that you can get. And this one we call an elastic solid. This is where the dynamical matrix is really describing the system. If I ping it, it will make a nice peak. I can use this to make a watch. You know, I have quartz crystal, I want to make a watch. I use the modes of that watch to ping, 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 and I'll get the same frequency out. In this region, I don't have that case anymore. I can ping this thing, but I won't get back my frequency, okay? In this one, it's just, look.
Wow.
Did I do something? I did, but just the forward, we go to the next slide button.
I think the quartz crystal didn't like
that. That's right. That was a bad analogy, apparently. Well, let's just give it a second. This detected it. I mean, this guy knows that it's connected. My computer knows it's connected. There we go. Okay. So Anyway, in this regime, we don't have that frequency response, that same sort of frequency response that we have in this regime. And of course, out here we have a liquid, so it's a totally different state. It's not really a solid. Okay, so we can ask, how does this affect certain things? And this, for example, is measuring the heat capacity. Okay, for a solid, the heat capacity is easy to measure. You can just take those equations that I talked about in the linear regime. You can measure the heat capacity, and you get 2 for the heat capacity. That's what you get, and that's what we see in this region. But along this line where things start to change, then that starts to change a bit. And by the time you get to this line, there's a very sharp transition where the heat capacity changes significantly. Okay, and the heat capacity changes significantly. I'm not going to talk about it today, but this whole region out here, even though it's the heat capacity is changing in this region, and we can, these are the contours of how it's changing. Even though it's changing out here, we can actually think of this whole region as one state or one type of states. Because if we take the dynamical matrix, we can actually scale it. There's one scale factor that we can use to scale the entire density of states out here. So we got it. Sorry. Thanks. So out here, this entire region acts like this disordered solid, this solid where it doesn't have peaks anymore. It's constantly breaking contacts, but it's not like a liquid yet. It still has the plateau. It doesn't seem to go upward. So there's a definite difference in behavior here. But we can take all the density of states here, and we can scale them. So this entire region is a scaling region. So we think this is all one type of state. So this is, just to make it clear, as I didn't mention it before, this is how compressed we are, okay? And this is how uncompressed we are. So this is above jamming, this is below jamming, okay? This is temperature in this region, and this is the heat capacity we find for a system in that state. Here are the three states that I talked about in the three different regimes. They were all at 10 to the minus 6 compression. Okay, so that's that. We were all along this line, but as we look as a function of compression, then we see this other behavior. So we think there's kind of two different sort of states here. This elastic solid that acts like a normal elastic solid, and then there's this other kind of solid which acts a little differently. And then each of these lines represents where it becomes a liquid, depending on how long we wait, actually. So obviously, you can wait longer and you'll see that you're liquid. Even that's true in a real solid, right? And eventually, even in a real solid, sorry again, real solid, atomic solid, you'll have diffusion. Okay, on a long enough time scale, you'll eventually have diffusion. So we wait longer and longer. I think this one was 10 to the 9 or something. So wait really long, you'll see this occur. We didn't wait that long for this picture, so it's somewhere right in here, like 10 to the 9, 6. Well, something like that, somewhere in here, is where this one transitions to that other state. Okay, so now I want to say a little bit, and this is sort of new stuff, and so I won't have as much detail on this, but I want to say what happens in these two types of solids when we shear it. Okay, so now I want to try to shear these things. Okay, so to do this, we're going to again use computer simulations, but we're going to use this sort of Lees-Edwards boundary condition. So this guy is in contact with another guy down here. So you have this and this. And so these, each computational cell is shifted with respect to the other, so that we can have some kind of set strain. Okay. And I guess that's supposed to be a gamma, but you know, it looks more like a Y. Anyway, gamma is our strain, and so we can set that strain to anything we want along this system. Okay. Now, what happens when we shear a system that's created this way? So we're going to create a jam packing, and these are in this linear regime. Okay, so this is supposedly in the linear regime. So these are very the compression is not very high, say 10 to the minus 6 again. Okay, so what happens when we shear? Well, the blue is what we get if we use double-sided springs. So if I take the exact same packing, so this is what you expect. If I take this packing and I put double-sided springs on, so I just, you know, in my code, I have a thing that says if the two particles are in contact, use a spring. If they're not in contact, don't use anything. I just turn off that, if they're not in contact, don't use anything. So I just have them have a regular linear spring. So they just have, everybody has linear springs. So this is a spring network, sort of a, you know, your high school condensed matter problem. Okay, this is a linear spring network. What is the elasticity of that linear spring network? And that's what you expect. Strain versus stress, you just have a line like this, no problem. That's what you expect. But in this system where you have contacts that can break, where you have, this, by the way, this is a constant volume. So in this system, when you have contacts that can break, though, if you go one way, you have linear elasticity. Everything looks good. But if you go the other way, you have nothing. You unjam it. And so one way, you always jam it. The other way, you always unjam it. Those are the two choices. You're either going to go this way and jam it, or you go this way and unjam it. Now, where this...
Did this one happen to line up at zero strain?
It's not actually at zero strain, but this is... I've got a strain of one on here. Okay, so this is... I mean, one of the system. It's not actually at the center. It's maybe 10 to minus 6 away from the center.
But it can happen anywhere.
So I was... Not anywhere. So I was going to mention that. This is not exactly at zero. And what happens is, the more compressed it is, the wider range you have here before you move out. So you might be able to go back further before you went to the other way around. If there's more overlaps, it's harder to it may take you a little while longer to break a contact.
Further in strain,
yes, not in time.
Must be doing interesting things too when you're shearing it.
The what?
The hydrostatic pressure must also be doing interesting things.
Yes, the pressure is increasing on this side. The pressure is increasing on this side, and obviously you're setting the pressure to zero. The pressure will be zero on the other side. Okay, now we can understand this because, as I mentioned last time, granular systems tend to be in these families. Okay, so we talked last time about the frictional families, about the contacts, the types of structures that we have in phase space when we have fewer than isostatic contacts. Okay. The same thing happens in strain space. So this is a plot of area fraction versus strain, okay? And all of these points are points that we found by compression. So we go to a particular strain and we compress. We go to a particular strain and we compress. Those are all the gray points. And you can see that they make these lines, okay? So there are these lines, these families in this space. And they're not connected here because I didn't actually strain them. Okay, I just did this randomly. I just randomly created these states. And up here you can see they're very nicely connected. That's because these are more probable. These happen more often. But these down here don't happen as often, but you can still see the linear nature of them. This one line is an example of what happens if I just compress something. I mean, if I just strain something. So I just started here and I strained it, and it did this, it followed this family, and it followed this family, and jumped. These should look familiar to everyone here. We've been looking at these. This is a big avalanche, this is another big avalanche. These are straining events, okay? So this is what happens in any particular. They're always following these families. Now, if we zoom in on one of these families, we can see what's going on here. So here we've zoomed in on one of these families. Let's look at this green one here, okay? So let's say I start here, and I start trying to shear it. Well, if I shear it, I'll be above it, okay? I'll be above this green one. If I shear it, I'm going across a constant volume, so I'll be above it. So that's good. So I'm more dense than it is, than the state is, and it'll be...
Strain zero is always defined by the zero pressure. Like, you reduce the pressure to precisely zero at strain zero.
No, not in this case. We could do that, and then we'd shift it for... In that case, there's a different strain for every state. So if you do that, you're right. That's probably the best way to do it. Probably, if you want to do it that way, that's probably a good way to do it. But then I can't show all the states on one diagram. Okay, all states cross the zero line. I mean, all the states that are here cross this. So this strain is set by the box shape. Okay, so this is the unstrained box, the unstrained periodic box. Okay, so I can plot all this. You're right. If I start here, if I have this density, I don't have a state that's there. So at this density, I'd have to have something like over here if I actually have a jammed state. So I'd have to move around, or I'd have to adjust. I'd have to adjust the density to find a state. But you're right. The point where zero strain is depends on which state I'm in. Okay, so that's the state where there's literally zero strain. That is, the system doesn't know there's strain. Okay, the box itself has another strain. So there's the external strain and there's the internal strain that it has. Okay, but I'm just thinking about sitting here at one of these where I found this state by compression. So I've gone up here and I found this green state by compression. So I'm going to be at zero strain for it, okay, when I start, and very nearly. It's going to depend on my overlap, is exactly how close I am. And if I were to increase my strain, I'll go over here. Now, my density is higher than the density of this state. And so this state will feel compressed, and so I'll have a shear. I'll have something like a shear modulus in this case because I have a pressure. But if I were to do the exact same thing but go the other way, Now that state's density is above mine, okay, and now I'm too dilute to see that as a state. There, all the particles lose contact, and I.
Okay. So I think what you're doing is you're finding an initial state that zero at a direct linear box with no Lees Edwards offset by the standard thing that you do, right? Then once you find that zero pressure state, that is jamming threshold, then you shear it. And what you're saying is that for the blue guy, you have to let the box dilate to remain at the isostatic point.
The blue guy is different from the green guy.
It's a different state. It's a different state. So it has a different contact network, different set of particles in different positions. So each one of the, let me try to explain it a little more clearly. So each one of these lines represents one of these families in this space. So like this family or this family, each one represents a certain contact network. So we have a certain contact network, certain position of all the particles. These are the states that we have. And these are jammed states. So these are all jammed states, just jammed states or very small compression. So for example, I could find this state in two ways. I could sit at the box shape like this and go up until I get it. That'd be one way I could find it. Or I could start here, I could find it at zero strain, and then I could strain the box. And in the same time, while I'm going down here, if I want to stay on this state, I'd also have to lower the density. I have to make the density lower if I wanted to stay on this state. But if I don't, if I do it in constant volume, which is what a lot of people do when they shear, if I shear at constant volume, I'll be going in straight lines because this is the density axis, so the density would stay the same. And with respect to this state that I'm in, I will now be overcompressed. I'll be compressing that state, okay? Because this state would like, at zero overlap, this state would like to have this density, but I'm at a higher density, so it's compressed, okay? So when I go this way, I compress the state. When I go this way, I decompress the state. And this is generic behavior for single-sided springs. When I go one way, I will compress the state. When I go the other way, I will, in effect, decompress the state, even though I'm staying at constant volume. And that's what leads to this fact that...
How do you say that the state is the same? Is it because the contact network...
The state is the same if the contact network doesn't change, right? So it'll have the same dynamical matrix entries. They'll be slightly different because the angles will have changed, mm-hmm. but the contact network will all be the same. I haven't changed any contacts. Okay, so I can follow it using linear theory essentially by just adjusting the strain of that dynamical matrix. Okay, so this is generic behavior because what you see is you don't see any states that are perfectly flat. Okay, this is the flattest one we have, and it's not perfectly flat. No states are. They all come in with an angle, and if you ask, it's roughly 50-50. So when you start straining something at constant volume that has single-sided springs, you have a 50-50 chance of breaking it. You know, and the other way you'll get strained, the other way you won't. So this is kind of a weird linearity. It's not linearity like you expect with double-sided springs. So if I do the same thing with double-sided springs, when I start going on this side, there'll be springs that will pull me back in. they'll pull me back in, and I'll have something where I have to work against those springs to stretch them. But my springs, once they're
when you increase the compression, mm-hmm. then they start bubbling the same way.
As you increase the compression, you have a larger and larger distance you can travel in strain space before those springs would break again. So if I started at this volume here, this is getting back to your point of where is zero strain. If I started here, if the box were here, you know, okay, let's say I'm here. If I start here on this green state, then I can strain in this direction, and I'll get a linear response. But once I get over here, then I would not have a linear response anymore. I'd have this flat curve. Okay. And so what we get is this case where in one way you have a linear response, the other way you have no response. Okay. So what we wanted to ask was what happens when we start increasing the temperature? Because this is what changes the state of these systems. Okay. Oops, going the wrong way. So now I'm going to change the temperature.
So I'm sure, yep. When you say linear, is the pressure also going up? Linearly, you're saying linear response, so you're looking at the stress strain curve, and you've got a linear stress okay. strain curve. Is what?
So what I'm saying is that the I'm not plotting the pressure here. Mm-hmm. So that's another question. The pressure is also going up. So sigma xx and sigma yy are both going up. All three of these are going up. So they're all going up together.
But you have looked at tau over p.
We do look at tau over p as well. No, not exactly. So it's more complicated. We can talk about it later, but it's more complicated than that. But P definitely plays a role in creating this type of strain. So this is created, the strain is, a lot of the strain is created because of the fact that we now have more and more pressure. But you still get a stress even if you were to do this at constant pressure. So if you do the constant pressure, you still get this a similar sort of result. It's a little different, but you still get a similar type result. Now let's look at what happens when we add temperature. Okay, so the blue ones are now the double-sided springs. So adding temperature, I have four different temperatures here, I think. Okay, so nothing happens. It's linear elasticity with a temperature. It doesn't really change that much. Okay, they're wiggling inside their wells as opposed to just sitting at the bottom of the well until I strain it. So they wiggle a little bit, but basically it still looks like perfect elastic behavior. But on the other side, when I have single-sided springs for the same state, this red curve is the one we saw before. Here's a little higher temperature, higher temperature, higher temperature. So this fact that you have these states where the system is constantly unjamming is affecting the stress-strain behavior of this system. So when I have a temperature, now it's like I'm running back and forth along this. On this case, if I'm just running back and forth along this line, the average is still back on this line. So if I'm running back and forth along this line and a different temperature, it's still the average is going to be here. So that's what I get. But when I'm doing it here, when I'm near here, I'm now bringing in this places where the thing breaks. And I no longer have a strong relationship between strain and stress. And so I get this kind of curved behavior. And this penetrates quite deeply as you get to higher and higher temperatures, because now you're spending more and more time in this state that's not jammed. Okay, I'm gonna finish up with this one last thing. This is kind of where we are, and so this is not as well developed. But we also want to look at something like what happens when you sort of just let the system go, sort of what happens. And so we did another experiment where we did a response to a step strain. Okay, so we're just gonna take the system and we're gonna strain it and leave it there and just let it evolve under constant energy equations. Okay, and here's what the stress does as a function of time. Okay, so the blue curve is the same elastic one. And you can see it recovers back to these high peaks all the time. But the green curve doesn't recover to such high peaks, but that's because it doesn't have these sharp peaks in its Fourier spectrum. It can't ever create a kind of resonance like you can in an elastic crystal. If we look over really long times, you can see this, that the blue curve continues to create these large recurrences. And this is because it's got all this stored elastic energy in these peaks. But in the green curve, it doesn't have nearly so much because the spectrum is spread out. And if we look at the Fourier transforms of these two curves, you can see that right away. The green curve's Fourier spectrum, it has some power, like this one has a fair amount of power at this peak, but for the most part, the spectrum is completely spread out. So we expect it to dephase quite a bit more than the case when you have these peaks. These red points are the dynamical matrix peaks, the dynamical matrix values for the frequency. If we zoom in, here's an example. We're exciting with this stress, with this strain, we're exciting this peak, and it's responding at that peak. If we were making this into a clock, we could use this as our frequency. We could be measuring this response and getting back out. We can filter out this and get this nice sharp response from this particular frequency. But if we were to filter this out, we would just get noise. We would not get this sharp response. Yeah, and it's the same thing all over. All these peaks correspond to the dynamical matrix peaks if you have double-sided springs. So linear theory works really well for the double-sided springs, which is, by the way, where it was developed. For molecular potential, but it doesn't work so well for these states where you have the single-sided springs. I could stop here if this is a good time, or I have a little bit I could say about avalanches. Say a little more about. Okay, so this is in, you know, Monty Python and now for something completely different. So we're doing these experiments on. I'll call them real avalanches now. Okay, so these are actual avalanches, and this is an experiment in my lab. So this is a two-dimensional avalanche. So we have two glass plates separated by about one particle diameter, and these are ball bearings. You can see the crystallization in there, but it's polycrystalline. And we're just rotating this very slowly. We're watching the avalanches as they go down the surface. And just to be clear, this is one layer of particles here. We're rotating this way, and we look at it from there. There's about 8,000 particles in this total thing. The across this sample along a diameter, there's 128 particles. So that's the size of the system. Okay, now in this system, we can have both large and small avalanches. Now I've taken this.
Is this monodisperse?
This is monodisperse. So I've taken this system, and we want to get the most out of our camera. So we've taken a swatch like this at an angle, because we want to get the most out of our camera. So gravity is down in this picture like one expects, but in these next two pictures, gravity is not going to be down. Okay? So gravity is in this direction. Okay, so this is just so we can get more out of our camera. Now this is a small avalanche. You may have missed it. Did you see that avalanche?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So let me show it again. Okay, so there it is. Did you see it there in that? That was that avalanche, because that's a tiny avalanche. That's one of our small avalanches, okay? And here's a big avalanche. Okay, it takes a minute for it. You can already see, let me just mention back up. So you can already see this one is this way. So it's, we're talking about this correlation between the angle and the size of the avalanche. So this one, you don't expect such a large avalanche. It's already almost perpendicular to gravity, the surface. But this one you can see is tilted. Even in our system, it's tilted even further. Is it going?
No.
There we go. Okay. So we're going to see this is going to be a big avalanche. It takes a minute for it to get to the avalanche part. But there it goes, starting. Okay, and then connects up. All. Okay, so that's a big avalanche. That's the one that destroyed all the houses. Okay, and now you can see the angle is actually even in our coordinate system is actually gone from this way to this way. And now it's almost perfectly perpendicular to gravity. Okay, so this is basically flattened it out in gravity space. Again, it's continuing on. We call this all one avalanche. The way we do the experiments, we rotate a small amount and then we wait a long time. Then we rotate a small amount and we wait a long time. So that's how we get these. And we just wait until everything stops moving before we're at the end of the avalanche. Okay, so now we can extract the size of the avalanches themselves as a function of time. And what we're actually measuring right now, and we're working on a different version of this right now, is we're actually measuring the number of particles that move. Okay, so here's an example. So we have these two guys and then the avalanche, and these two guys move, the answer will be two. Okay, two moved. Okay, one nice thing about this measurement is that it's discrete, so we have only digital noise. We have no inherent noise. This we can tell whether they move to very high accuracy, and so it's either on or off. So it gives us a very strict control over our noise. The downside is that if these two, like in that large avalanche you saw, if we had the same number of particles move but they didn't move as far, we probably should consider that other avalanche as a bigger avalanche than one where that number of particles move but they didn't move as far. So we're also working now on another technique where we both count the number of particles and the distance they move. So we have to do a little bit better on our imaging so we can track every single particle. But we have that working now. And so in the next few weeks, we should have the answer for the total size. And that'll show up we'll have a kind of cutoff at large sizes, you'll see in a second. So these are individual avalanches. Each one of these is an individual avalanche. Let me focus in on one. So this is one really big avalanche, like the one we just saw. Okay. And then there's a break. It's hard to see on the scale, but there's a break right there. And then here's another smaller avalanche. Here's a larger break. And then that's also an avalanche, because that's a little tiny avalanche. So this is sort of the scale of avalanches we have. From this, we can extract the time of the avalanche and some sort of measure of the peak of the avalanche, either the area, which is what we do, but various things can be done. So the area under this determines the size of the avalanche and the time of the avalanche. We have the statistics on the distance between the avalanche for some other places where we do a constant strain, but we haven't really looked at it in detail. But we do see some sort of correlation like we were talking about. So here's a plot of the avalanche duration as a function. Sorry, this is avalanche. Oh yeah, avalanche. This is avalanche size as a function of time. This shouldn't say avalanche duration. So you can see a nice power law up to a point. Okay, so at this point, there's two possibilities why we're looking into this. One is that these are piling up because that problem that I said about the number. Maybe some of the largest avalanches are larger because the same number of particles move, but they move further. So if that was the case, we could get larger avalanches, you know, by doing that. Sorry, this is the small end. Okay, let me just make sure I know this. These are large avalanches, these are small end. Sorry, this side is for most likely because of the finite size of our system. Okay, so that's what we're checking now by making the system larger. Okay, so that's that size. And now we can look at the, she's labeled both of these the same, so now I'm a little confused. This is time. Let me start over because I got confused because these are in the wrong order. This is the time of the avalanche. Okay, so this is the time it takes, the duration of the avalanche. Sorry about that. I thought they were in the other order. Okay, so this is the duration. This is tau. Okay, and this is right. Avalanche duration. I should have trusted Aileen. Aileen is the one who does all the work. That's why I know nothing about it. So this is a power law, and the power law is minus 1.67. Okay, so that's that power law. And then we can also look at the size of avalanches, and we also have a power law in those with the exponent of minus 1.36.
Size being
the area under the curve of how many particles move as a function of time.
That's really the total number.
Yeah. Just the total number, yeah. Total number. Yeah.
Times
well, no, not necessarily.
Times the time that they're moving. It's the total number times the time they're moving. But it doesn't include the total distance they've traveled in a very rigorous way.
It does not.
Not in a rigorous way. Not in the way that we actually track how far they move. But it's a kind of indicator of it, because we take at each frame, we ask how many particles move from frame to frame. That's what we were plotting, how many particles move from frame to frame. And then we integrate all of that over time. But they could still, if they move a lot from one frame to the next, we're just counting them as having one moving. But if they move a lot during one frame, then we wouldn't get that. And that's the part where we might have that might be able to go to larger.
You're saying that this bump at the large end may be an artifact.
So that could be an artifact of this.
That could be what happens in real earthquakes.
It also is what happens in real earthquakes. So we have that. It could be real. So there's a couple possibilities. It could be real. This is just what happens in these earthquakes. And when we double the size of the system, it'll sit right there. So that's one possibility. So it could be, doesn't depend on the size of the system, and it just sits right there. It's something that's happening. Like, for example, one possibility is that there's only a finite angle, set of angles between the two. So there's only a maximum size of avalanche you can get based on angle. And without it, you that's the only.
Even in the real earthquakes, that's called the characteristic earthquake, where it depends on which fault it's on.
Yes, so that's why it could be something internal to the system, yeah.
And you could also check the total size. You just take the configuration before and after and calculate center of mass.
Yeah, yeah.
In the horizontal direction before and after. This will give you this total size.
Okay,
Very precise. So
we did that. That's how we started. That's the way we started doing this measurement. But the problem with that is that what is the shape of the surface? Okay, so the shape of the surface is not just a flat structure. There's structure on it. So you can't just represent it by one number, essentially. We don't get the noise in the small end is way too big. We stop here. We don't get any of this data if we do that, because we've ignored the fact that very tiny earth, that tiny one I showed in the beginning, that wouldn't have changed the actual slope. That, you know, three particles bounce along the top surface, it doesn't change the actual slope. If we just use the slope as the measurement, the average slope as the measurement, we don't get these tiny
events. Take the center of Mars.
We also tried that as well.
Before and after.
We also tried that as well. So the center of mass has a problem that you have your there's a huge mass of the whole thing that is a very large number, and you're trying to measure very tiny numbers with respect to that very large number, and so again you lose the smallest piece of information. They fall into the noise of the camera, you know, there's vibrations of the various things, and so you're trying to measure this entire picture, all the particles, and find the positions of all the particles to find their center of mass. Then you have noise for each particle. All the particles that aren't moving add to your noise, and so you don't get as good results at the small.
You can't take just off the particles which are not moving.
Well, then the center of mass moves because of other reasons. Then the center of mass is, because you're not taking the same particles each time. The center of mass is not conserved for a subset of the system. because it's interacting with the rest of the system. We can talk about it later, but the, yeah.
No
worries. Okay.
I just wanted to say, the bump, for some reason, I always thought that was just inertia, so that if you would do rise pods or something, you wouldn't get that.
It's possible. That's another possibility. Okay. So it could be just the size of the system. This is just the largest one we can get. Uh-huh. So that's one possibility. So we're going to do a system that's half the size and a system that's twice as big to see if that's the case. It could be, like you're saying, just inertia that that causes this to occur. You could see inertia in the movie. Mm-hmm. You could see that it was really flowing rather than just, you know, stepping along. So that's definitely a possibility for this as well. It could also be this problem that we're not totally capturing the size at the large end. Mm-hmm. Not totally capturing it because particles could move more during one frame than what we're considering. It one particle moved during one frame. If it moves a long distance, one particle moves a long distance during one frame, then that would not count. So we do it at those pictures were taken one picture wait, one picture wait, one picture wait. We're not taking movies of each event. If a particle moves, we're just continually taking a movie at a high frame rate, and we just continually check to see if anything happened in that frame. Anything that happens in a frame, we keep those frames and then we post-process it afterwards so we can get actually every particle's movement, the total trajectory of every single particle. Then we can also do something like what you were talking about. Once we have every particle's motion directly as a function of time, then we can actually measure some of these things more accurately. But we weren't doing that in the beginning. We're just measuring the at a snapshot. So we just snapshot, wait. And so that was the way it was before. So it could be that, but we want to try to come to the bottom. Although we have a pretty good, you know, we have, you know, 5 decades here and 4 decades here. So for an experiment, you know, a tabletop experiment, I think we're doing pretty well on the power law. I'm not really worried about this. I want to have something to say to the referee when they say, well, why is there a bump there? So that's the main thing there. So this is the size scaling. We can also do this average avalanche shape measurement. Okay, so we can bend the avalanches based on size and the scaling regime. So here's a tiny avalanche, here's a medium avalanche, and here's a large avalanche. We scale them all to be between 1 and 1, 1 and 1, and 1. Then we put them all on the same plot. We add them all up. You guys all know how this works. And we get our parabola, except it's not quite a parabola. It's a little bit skewed. So the green curve is a parabola. The blue curve is our actual data. So it's a little bit skewed. But you have this sort of mean value, whatever.
I'm sorry. Just a slide before, it was the number of particles moving during.
So each point represents the, in this plot, it's the fraction from the maximum of particles that moved during that time element.
For different avalanches.
Okay. So, you know, if we had this on real scale, this would be 2 particles moved, 4 particles moved, 6 particles moved, 5 particles moved, 5 particles moved, no particles moved. So that's the way it is. And the area represents its size, and that's how we scale it. So we put everybody who has the same area in the same bin, and we scale them all this way. And then we put them all in the same plot and average them all together. Okay. We just, to get them all to have the same thing, we just fit them using P-chip spline. So try not to add anything from our spline.
You said same area.
Yes, maximum here. Maximum. You're right. Maximum. Thank you. Okay, but then we get this same, kind of universal shape, which is close to a parabola, but not perfectly a parabola. So just a sort of comparison. The mean field theory is 1.5. We get 1.36. Duration is 2. We get 1.67. We have this symmetric parabola. Ours is asymmetric, but it's not crazy asymmetric, right? This is something else we can talk about later. Okay, so anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about today. Thanks for your attention. Mm-hmm.